You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The NSA continues to be headline news as Edward Snowden's leaks continue to be made public. Yet as we learn more about the agency's spying programs, journalists are finding it harder to get government sources to come forward to discuss national security, intelligence, and law enforcement. On Monday, Human Rights Watch published a 120-page report called With Liberty to Monitor All, How Large-Scale U.S. Surveillance is Harming Journalism, Law, and American Democracy. It details the chilling effect it's having on journalists and lawyers and the elaborate steps they have to take to keep communications private. I'm very pleased to welcome the author of the report, Alex Sinha, to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How many people did you talk to for this report?
I spoke with nearly 50 journalists, mostly covering national security, law enforcement, and intelligence. A lot of those are leading journalists in the field. I also spoke with over 40 attorneys and firms covering a wide range of practice areas. And I spoke with five senior, current, and former government officials, all with knowledge of the programs.
And they were working for a wide range of media outlets?
That's right. Many of them are at major media outlets, but some were at smaller ones as well.
Were most of the journalists and lawyers forthcoming? How difficult is it these days to get people to discuss this issue?
I had a decent response when I tried to reach out to people. I think the biggest impediment was that people are very busy. There are certainly people who were concerned about talking about these issues and wanted to do it in a certain way, and we had to reach out carefully and meet in person, but in general, it wasn't too bad.
In light of the revelations about the NSA, are journalists changing their tactics when they communicate with sources?
Absolutely, especially when they're covering areas like these, national security and intelligence and so forth. They feel the need to take very elaborate steps sometimes to protect their sources, knowing now that the government has the ability to collect so much information and so many records of those communications.
What kinds of steps?
The ones that stand out the most in a way are the high-tech steps, the IT security steps. So a lot of journalists, a surprising number, reported to me that they use burner cell phones, right, which are disposable cell phones, prepaid, usually purchased with cash.
Sounds like a spy film.
That's what a couple of them said, that it makes them feel like they're spies or that they're doing something wrong. A couple of others also said that they've been using air-gapped computers, which are computers that don't connect to unsecured networks. It's kind of like a typewriter with a CPU attached. And then a few also reported using encryption services, not just for email, but for chat.
Are encryption services, are they safe?
It's a big question.
Can't they
right
be
now.
Broken?
So some of the journalists actually and some of the attorneys also declined to use encryption because they think it can be broken. There are debates about this right now and about how much you want to rely on it. And even if it is secure, one thing that encryption on its own won't do is hide the fact that you are communicating with a particular person.
I'd imagine it also slows down the whole process.
Yes, that's the big problem, really, in a way. Between source skittishness and the slow process of reporting in these areas, those two forces together are combining to make less information available to us as a public.
You're right. The biggest worry is not that the NSA will find a way to crack encryption, but rather that one's electronic hygiene in using it must be excellent. What does that mean?
So that means that it's very easy, especially if you're new to using those kinds of techniques, to fail to do something that's important to maintain the encryption. And so some of the journalists reported concerns, especially when dealing with sources who don't know how to use encryption, that somebody might make a misstep, might omit an important step and send something that's supposed to be encrypted in unencrypted form.
And I'd imagine that when you ask a government employee to use encrypted email or not to talk on the cell phone, that might scare them off.
That was also something that reporters told me. That's definitely true.
When you use encryption, does that raise red flags with government agencies that are interested?
It certainly can, and the NSA has special rules for holding encrypted communications longer than unencrypted ones under certain conditions, and so there's definitely a bit of a concern there, yeah.
How do you even use encryption? I've always wanted to do it, but I'm not sure why I would want to do it.
Sure. It's a little cumbersome for people who are new to it, but there are all sorts of different ways to do it. There's software there's free software online that you can use to encrypt your emails. And basically, it just interposes a step between sending emails and receiving them, and sort of scrambles the message.
Edward Snowden wanted encryption applied when he dealt with Glenn Greenwald and others. And actually, I think Greenwald resisted using encryption, which slowed that whole connection down.
I've heard that story, yes. I understand that Edward Snowden is one of the more sophisticated sources to come forward recently in terms of his ability to use these kinds of technologies.
You think that's one of the reasons he's still not in jail?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, did Chelsea Manning use encryption as well? Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly how the Manning leaks came about. I don't have a clear sense.
Congress broadened the FISA laws, forming the legal basis for many of these programs. But couldn't you argue that these programs far exceed Congress's intent when it created the laws?
Certainly some people argue that. I mean, the use, for example, of Section 215 of the Patriot Act to collect massive amounts of domestic metadata seems to have upset the author, key author of the Patriot Act, Representative Sensenbrenner, who said that's not what we had in mind.
But he wouldn't have known about it without the Snowden leaks.
That seems to be true, yeah.
Just yesterday, CIA Director John Brennan apologized to the leaders of the Senate Intelligence Committee for spying on their panel. Have we come to a situation where no one, no matter how powerful, is safe from being spied on by a government intelligence agency?
I mean, I think the worry is that they have so much power and they have the ability so cheaply and so easily to store the data that we shouldn't take it for granted that we're safe. And I think what we want now is to push back on that and to get into a more sustainable situation where we don't have to worry because of the power that they have that they can abuse it if they wanted to.
My guest is Alex Sinha, S-I-N-H-A. His report for Human Rights Watch is With Liberty to Monitor All, How Large-Scale U.S. Surveillance is Harming Journalism, Law, and American Democracy. You also write that subject to minimalization, the government can collect and use internationally shared data of Americans under Section 702 of FISA. What is it? Is it minimization?
Minimization, yes.
What is minimization?
Minimization is just a term that the government uses for a set of procedures usually applied by the agencies that actually gather intelligence information. So the NSA, for example, has minimization procedures. And those procedures dictate the rules for controlling and limiting the use and dissemination of data that they acquire. For example, then, if you are trying to target some group in another country and you pick up emails that are between an American and somebody outside the United States, there are certain rules for how the NSA handles those emails or quarantines those emails once it realizes that one of the parties is a U.S. person.
The FISA courts are supposed to be there as a protection, but as I understand it, they have pretty much signed off on everything. There are just a few cases that they didn't allow go through.
The numbers I've seen on that are that the FISA court generally and sort of overwhelmingly complies with government requests. I mean, I think it's not 100%, but it's very close to 100% of the time.
Now, a lot of this has to do with classified material. How much information does the government classify?
A lot. I think in 2012 alone, the government made over 95 million distinct decisions to classify or reclassify information.
In a couple of cases, as we've heard recently, non-classified material was classified after the fact when the government brought a case against somebody who had been a whistleblower.
Well, this line between classified and unclassified is actually a major kind of focus of the report in a way, because part of what we found is that given the context, which is that the government is cracking down on leaks, sources don't want to talk about unclassified information either. And unclassified information, more or less by definition, is not something the government has a legitimate interest in protecting from the public.
What are some of the penalties a government employee could face for leaking classified information?
It can range from, you know, loss of a security clearance, which in D.C. could kill your career, to firing, to investigation and criminal prosecution. those who have been accused of leaking and actually prosecuted have incurred massive expenses, sometimes, you know, mortgaging their houses or whatnot to try and pay for their legal defenses. So it's a range of penalties, but pretty severe penalties.
The Obama administration has pursued 8 prosecutions of officials for allegedly releasing information to the press, more than all previous administrations combined. Why do you think that they have been going after leakers so aggressively?
It's hard to say. When I spoke to an official at the Department of Justice, he said he's not aware of any specific policy that explains that. And to a lot of government officials, this is just floating within the margins. But one possibility is just that so much more information is available. And so if the government doesn't like a story, they don't like certain information that appeared in a newspaper article, they have the ability to go get those records and pursue the case.
Richard Nixon was criticized for wiretapping people in the government who he suspected of being leakers. So things have changed over the years?
Well, I think what's changed now is because of the nature of digital communications, because of how much of our lives are contained in digital information, we are so much more susceptible to anything related to surveillance, whether it's data, actual communications, or metadata, which is the information about our transactions.
Can you describe President Obama's insider threat program?
Sure.
How does it affect journalists who cover government agencies?
So the insider threat program is a major factor combined with the increase in leak prosecutions, which has set this unfriendly environment for national security and intelligence reporters. The program was instituted in October of 2011 in response, we think, to the Manning leak. And the idea there was to crack down on leaks of certain kinds of information to the press. And among other things, it requires many federal agencies pretty much across the board to institute their own systems to help have their own employees monitor each other and inform on one another, among other things, for suspicious behavior that might reveal an intention to leak information to the press.
Has this been applied to James Risen of the New York Times?
Well, I don't know which pieces of information in that case have been acquired from insider threat kind of programs versus surveillance versus standard law enforcement techniques. I haven't had access to that information.
The government kind of backed down after there was an outcry, but that seems to be the only way that someone like James Risen might avoid going to jail.
Yeah, so the Risen case is an interesting case because it shows that even though the sources are really the ones who are under fire right now, it's not as if the journalists can't face penalties. We don't know.
He can be forced to tell who his sources are, even though supposedly journalists are protected for that?
Apparently that's the applicable ruling right now, which is that he may have to disclose or else be sent to prison. And, you know, we're urging Attorney General Holder not to pursue that.
Are we seeing a trend with each new president? Has each administration been more secretive than the last? I thought this was all supposed to end with Watergate.
It sounds like many reporters believe, they say this every time. One of the people in the report said this: we say this every time, and it's true every time. Each subsequent administration is more secretive than the last.
But we don't have a church committee in Congress. There doesn't seem to be anybody in Congress who wants to do much about it other than complain.
Yeah, so, you know, the church committee and the House committees that went along with it were a first step. They were a first attempt at intelligence oversight in Congress. And what followed from that were, you know, standing committees in the Senate and in the House that do this kind of oversight. But there are legitimate questions about how effective that oversight has become, especially now that we know, for example, that the CIA can spy on the overseers. So there are a lot of limits on what we can see from Congress on this.
Besides email and cell phone calls, are there any other electronic communications that we know that the NSA is collecting?
Well, we know that the NSA is collecting a lot of photographs and address books, international kind of chat address books. They're collecting, I think, a number of things that just flow along international internet cables. So there's actually a pretty wide range of data that they are able to go after.
My guest is Alex Sinha, who wrote a report for the Human Rights Watch called "With Liberty to Monitor All." how large-scale U.S. surveillance is harming journalism, law, and American democracy. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Alex Sinha, S-I-N-H-A. He has written a report for Human Rights Watch and the ACLU called With Liberty to Monitor All, How Large-Scale U.S. Surveillance is Harming Journalism, Law, and American Democracy. Before the Snowden leaks, were sources more forthcoming, or were they still worried about government surveillance?
I think before the Snowden leaks, the major elephant in the room was the leak prosecutions, combined maybe with the insider threat program. What the Snowden leaks have done is really brought home the power of the government. They really help bring out what it is that we're vulnerable to. And we know these programs are massive, but we also know that the boundaries are kind of amorphous. And so it's particularly scary now in a way that it wasn't before.
James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, issued a directive on March just this year that prohibits intelligence community employees from all unauthorized contact with the press. Isn't that a violation of the First Amendment? And also whistleblower laws?
I mean, we certainly think it raises First Amendment questions. We understand the government's need to protect classified information, and so certainly the journalists I spoke with understand that need as well. If the government has to protect national security, that includes information, the release of which could jeopardize national security. But because so much of the information they classify doesn't actually do that, and because so much of the information we're losing is unclassified, it's clear that these policies and rules like that one are overbroad.
The British have handled it simply by having a law that says all this stuff will be released 50 years from now. But that kind of makes it impossible to know what's really going on.
Yeah, we have similar rules as far as when something is classified, you know, the person classifying it picks a time frame for when the information is supposed to become declassified. But again, it comes about so many years later that it's not helpful in the immediate moment.
Can people lose their security clearance just for talking with journalists?
I think that answer depends on the agency. I have heard stories. One of the journalists I spoke to talked about how his outlet developed a relationship with a source over the course of a year, eventually ran a story based on information from that source. The source provided only unclassified information, but when the employer, a federal agency, discovered that this information had been released, they were able to go back, track back, find the connection from a year earlier and fire the source.
So it's not just government employees who are covered, but also outside contractors?
As far as I understand it, that's true, although most of the reporters I talked to focused on government sources per se.
Is there any appeals process if a government employee loses his or her security clearance?
I'm not entirely sure how it works when a government employee loses a security clearance as far as the appeals process goes. It's hard to know really on the inside whether these firings that are taking place, to the extent that they are a result of insider threat or something else.
Despite these prosecutions and government surveillance programs, Chelsea, formerly Bradley Manning, and Edward Snowden provided huge leaks to news sources. So are these government prosecutions going to stop people who are determined enough to expose classified information from doing that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think a number of the journalists I spoke with believe some version of the following theory. When you crack down on leaks across the board, when you make it scarier to talk to the press about anything, you chase away casual sources. You chase away less committed sources. And what that may mean is that the only sources who come forward are the ones who are going to make it worth their while to do that. They're going to be the ones who have something big and a lot of information that they are willing to release. So that's one possibility.
Are there government officials who think of journalists as engaging in criminal behavior?
We've heard some statements from members of the administration, I guess one member of Congress, suggesting that journalists involved in publishing the Snowden material are accomplices or something like that.
Glenn Greenwald, for example.
Right. So exactly. And fortunately, you know, the U.S. has not yet prosecuted journalists directly, which would be a different step and a worse step.
We have prosecuted leakers. How many years was Chelsea Manning sentenced to?
It was over 30 years, I believe. I mean, it's a significant sentence, a very long sentence.
On the other hand, there are government-sanctioned leaks to the press.
Yes.
So what's the distinction between a permissible and an impermissible leak?
I think the distinction is based on how much a high-level official wants the information in the press. A couple of the journalists did complain about a double standard on leaks, and they said, look, most of the classified information you read in the news comes from authorized leaks that are meant to shape a narrative.
And when you read them in the New York Times, say, they will often say, we can't reveal who told us this, but we got that information. It's usually somebody who's doing it at the behest of the government.
That seems to be the case. That's certainly the complaint that I heard from a number of the journalists.
So they see a double standard.
Absolutely.
Then there's the whole matter of lawyers being affected by these NSA spying programs. We assume that there's a confidential relationship between a lawyer and a client, but has that been undermined?
It definitely has been undermined. I mean, among the attorneys I spoke with, the ones who are most concerned about this are defense attorneys, but not exclusively. And for them, you know, they have professional obligations to maintain confidentiality. They have this need to exchange information freely with their clients to build trust and to build, you know, a rapport and legal strategy. And those are all undermined when they can't be confident in the security of their communications.
Is this just in matters of top secret issues? Because a couple of weeks ago, didn't the courts decide that prosecutors could read the email communications between the accused and their lawyers?
I'm not familiar with that decision, but I know that these concerns have reached attorneys who work in other areas besides national security type cases. So defense attorneys doing drug cases, civil attorneys representing foreign sovereigns. There's a whole range of people who are very concerned about it.
My guest is Alex Sinha. His report for Human Rights Watch and the ACLU is With Liberty to Monitor All, How Large-Scale U.S. Surveillance is Harming Journalism, Law, and American Democracy. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So what's happening with the lawyers? Are they adopting the same kinds of security tactics as the journalists?
They are. A lot of them did talk about encryption, and they talked about air-gapped computers again and so forth. Another technique that's used by both is really cutting in the opposite direction, which is just to say you use less technology altogether and you try to do more meetings face-to-face. You try to do more.
They can be bugged as well, can't they?
I suppose that's possible, but none of that has been detailed in Snowden-type revelations. And so I think people feel more comfortable if they can meet face-to-face or write notes to each other in the same room or something like that.
And then swallow the papers they do in the spy movies.
One of the attorneys did that. One of the attorneys I spoke with reported doing that.
Can you describe the revelations about the U.S. law firm Mayer Brown?
The revelations there were that this firm, it's a Chicago-based, a large firm, was representing the government of Indonesia in some sort of matter, a civil matter, I think related to trade negotiations. And the Australian analog to the NSA apparently collected communications between the firm and the client in that case and then offered to share that information with the NSA. And that would be, you know, the kind of thing that would concern any number of lawyers because even a big corporate firm like that in a non-criminal matter appears to be vulnerable.
But it also suggests that the United States isn't alone in doing this sort of thing.
No, we know.
Australia collected the information. It decided to share it. It could have kept it secret.
Well, we know that the U.S. has a very robust information sharing arrangement with several governments, including Australia. The others are New Zealand, the U.K., and Canada. They call themselves the Five Eyes, which is a little Orwellian. And they probably share a great deal of information because they have an agreement to do so. So I wouldn't take it for granted that much information collected by one is kept secret from the others.
Do attorneys or clients have any legal recourse if they believe that they've been spied on by a government agency?
I've not been able to find much evidence of strong legal recourse. I believe there are legal challenges in place right now that may tilt that toward the other direction.
Have people been suing the U.S. government?
Yeah, I mean, there are suits ongoing, and some are more successful than others, but most are still pending, and so it's very hard to know, You know, it helps to know now what we know from Edward Snowden, which is that certain kinds of communications are definitely collected. Because before, when people tried to sue and say, we think we're affected, that was not considered sufficient. But now that we know certain communications are collected or certain records are collected, that may change the calculus in the courts.
When you brought these concerns to the government officials that you interviewed, what was their reaction?
They were very generally opposed to the idea that there might be harms caused by the programs. They generally just said, look, we don't think that journalists are affected. We still see stories in the newspaper that have classified information. We don't think lawyers are that affected, although they had even less to say about lawyers. But they're sort of penned into that position. They kind of have to say that.
Well, they have to explain why when James Risen, getting back to him, wanted to publish some articles in the New York Times, he and and Sulzberger and the editor at the time were called into the White House and asked not to do that. And this wasn't a unique situation. I think even Watergate, there was a lot of pressure on the Washington Post to not publish those reports.
Sure. I understand that those kinds of communications, those kinds of discussions happen a lot.
And they in all those cases, well, in the case of the Risen revelations, the Times was told, if you publish these, you're going to put a lot of people into danger. And, of course, that will always scare off a newspaper.
Well, it's true that this is a dialogue, I think, that many of the journalists I spoke with engage in routinely. When they have something that they want to publish but they realize may be endangering someone else, they do have these negotiations and they try to sort out what's a real threat from what's kind of overblown. And a lot of them are very responsible about that and very careful.
Do these revelations make it more difficult for the United States to speak out against spying abroad, in Russia, in China, in Iran?
I would think that's absolutely the case. I mean, we know we're not the only ones doing large-scale surveillance, but we have to be among the most powerful, if not the most powerful, in that domain.
On the other hand, many government officials will insist that these programs are the only way to monitor terrorist activities. Does that suggest that it's unlikely that lawmakers will curb the NSA's power?
It certainly suggests that there's an argument in the government's pocket that they like to bring out for this kind of thing, and it's a hard argument to get people to push back on. But I don't think we should take it for granted that it's true. You can certainly imagine how having too much information actually makes us less safe because the government has too many dots to connect and can't make the links that it needs to. For example, the Boston Marathon bombing was not stopped by all these surveillance programs. But even if we did concede, even if hypothetically we say that the government collecting all this information does make us a little bit safer, we'd still need to know what we're trading for that safety. And this report should suggest that the costs of allowing the government to collect so much information are not trivial, and they need to be factored into our discussion about where to draw the line.
What is your sense? Has the crackdown scared off people, or are we pretty much seeing the same sort of thing we've seen in the past?
Based on the interviews I did, I'm convinced that we are seeing fewer stories, that we are seeing less information about government activity at a time when we really need more rather than less.
Alex Sinha's report for Human Rights Watch and the ACLU is With Liberty to Monitor All, How Large-Scale U.S. Surveillance is Harming Journalism, Law, and American Democracy. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.